It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
So, spontaneously, a few days ago, I started watching a lot of videos from one of your girlfriends.
What's that?
Young lady by the name of Jenny Nicholson.
Oh, wow. I don't think I've seen one of her videos for a long time.
I'm not sure she does them anymore.
Yeah.
The most recent ones that's coming up with are like from 2021.
Oh, yeah. I used to think she was pretty funny.
Yeah, you had me watch a couple of her things. And consequently, it just lives in the back of YouTube's mind now. And every once in a while, and I've been like, no, they're really long. I don't think I want to. But then as time has gone on, I am watching a lot more longer YouTube videos. And it particularly tried to offer me one where she was really pissed off about Star Wars Episode 9. So I was like, I got to do this. And I had a really good time. So I've been watching a few of them now.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says, because her whole deal is basically to very cleverly shit on things, which is, in general, something I avoid, but right now I'm really digging it. But it is funny, because you are the one who introduced me to her, but even outside of that, I could have told you, like, this is... She's got the energy of a lot of professional women that I know you admire. you have a type. I've known you long enough. You have a type, and she's in there. I keep wanting to say she's got big Rita Rudner energy, but that might be a little bit too far back for a lot of people. She gives me very strong Joe Firestone, who I know you are quite a fan of.
Yeah.
There's just a style of like cute and cutting in a adorkable sort of package that
yeah, that's
very your kind of deal. But yeah, I've been having fun watching some of her stuff.
Yeah.
Like, man, now YouTube's always just super excited when I watch anything that's not one of the five or six channels I normally watch. So it's just like, oh my god, do you want to watch everything she's ever done?
Yeah. Wow, I haven't.
No.
I don't know if I don't like subscribe to any channel she's on anymore or what, but
yeah, the oldest stuff I can find was like 2021. Sometime in lockdown, it appears that it stopped, but I don't know. Her videos also have millions of views, so she clearly was successful.
Yeah, she was popular for a while. But like, you know, like Ryan George, that guy's a machine. I mean, he just like
very much
going. And that's kind of what you have to do, I guess, because you know, you can get millions of views even consistently over say a year or two, but if you stop or take too long a break, it's like it never happened. So that's a little...
I don't know why the people whose YouTubes I watch now give a little bit more of the sort of behind the curtain stuff. Jordan Breeding does a lot of that.
Yeah.
Because he's still trying to figure it out and he's very open about like exploring what works and what markers he's going for versus what YouTube is going for. But the OX people do it too sometimes. And it's very interesting. It's caused me to sort of look at YouTube videos differently and reiterate how much we were never going to be huge. Because like the real basic levels of effort and energy involved are already just so outside of anything I ever wanted to bother with.
Yeah, I mean, most people who have made it on YouTube have put far more work into it than a lot of people realize. Now, some people have gone viral with something, but then after that, they had to build off of, I mean, you know, had to turn into a job after that. But for a lot of people who kind of got onto YouTube with the idea, I'm going to make something out of this, it's a lot of work. And then again, for the people who accidentally fall into it, from that point on, it's a lot of work. It's a full-time job.
And we see it because history is littered with one-hit wonder YouTubers. Yeah. Like that one, the one that sticks out to me, probably because something else referenced it recently, the Numa Numa Kid in the early days of YouTube. There is a song that includes the phrase Numa Numa several times, and this kid did a lip sync of it where he looked ridiculous, and it was funny, and it was all over the internet, and for a while it was the biggest thing. And then like 4 years later, he tried to do a sequel like intentionally, and it didn't go viral. And then that's the last we've all heard of. there's tons of those.
Yeah.
For every Bubs and Grumpy Cat out there, there's Keyboard Cat. Y'all remember Keyboard Cat? Yes. Do you remember a second Keyboard Cat video? No.
Well, and sometimes it takes people a while. Like Ryan, he did a lot of things for a long time before anything hit. And then he combined some things. Like I've noticed that his time traveler thing is actually quite old. That time traveler.
Yeah.
And he incorporated some of that into pitch meeting. And then the time travel sketch kind of went a different direction. But so, you know, you've got to be very clever. You've got to be willing to
change. And he's looking for this stuff. His revisited videos talk a lot more about what he's doing and what he was thinking of doing. And he's the first to admit, part of his success now is a luck of timing thing. Like there are certain pitch meetings that hit right when the zeitgeist was open to that particular thing and that kind of stuff. He works at, but yeah, at the point where somebody, one of them was talking about the strategy in picking your thumbnail, I was like, oh no, this is so much more effort than just having a job would be.
Yeah, right. It's,
and I don't want one of those.
I mean, these people are entrepreneurs, really. And like any entrepreneur, you're not working just 40-hour weeks. I mean, sometimes maybe, and you can take time off like a lot of entrepreneurs can do. But for the most part, it's a lot of work. It's a full-time job. If you work at it long enough, it might turn into something that's 40 or even for some really successful creators, 30 hours. But it's a lot of work. And the fact of the matter is, too, a lot of people who run channels, because there's like independent, like people who are doing independent news channels, independent journalism or whatever. Well, those like people us. Want, yeah, those people want, they don't mind, you know, 60-hour weeks. They like it. They like working the news. They like making things on weekends. They don't really mind it. So there are a lot of creators that are churning stuff out all the time, and they kind of like that. It's fun for them.
Yeah, and if it's your passion, then
sure,
yeah,
right. But there's a lot of them that would like it just to be constrained to a 9-to-5 or even less. And it's like any other entrepreneurial pursuit. Yeah, that's hard, and it might never be that. It might, you know, it might be a thing that you just work 80 hours a week for 10 years, and then hopefully by then you've made enough money or done enough that you can, you know, quit and not do anything for a while. But that's
what I'm hoping for. Well, hey, you know, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world who knows exactly how much effort it takes to be successful and has decided, nah. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 652. What I was going to say was, when I was running Jesus and My Grandpappy, I did a lot of stuff to get that to actually be something. You know, it wasn't just a hobby. I was like, well, let's see if I can, you know, sell my books, sell any of the other content. And I didn't have zero success at that. I got more people to the site. It got pretty good traffic there for a while. I made some money on things I was doing. Not a lot.
Not sure it's worth your immortal soul.
But
that seems
it was a ton of work. It was a ton of work. And it's like mining. You're prospecting all the time for your audience. Because, you know, everybody who's on the internet is a potential person that's going to be interested in your site, which, you know, at this point, I don't know how many people it was back then, but this like billions of people. And the great thing about it is there's pretty much an audience for everything. I mean, if anything proves that, it's porn, right? I mean, there's every kind of pornography out there. There's an audience, literally an audience for everything. Someone's going to like what you're doing, maybe enough people that you could make a living, maybe not a great living. Maybe you won't be a household name, but you know, you could quit your job and you could do whatever you're doing full time, but you have to find them. And they're probably spread out all over the world. And to find them and to keep them is a full-time job. And you might do all that work and not even be successful because they are difficult to find. And they want to find you, but they're, you know.
I think that was our big hiccup. I think ultimately I was hoping that whatever it was we do here would turn out to be somebody's kink and sexual fetish. But you're right. I mean, we have to find those. I mean, not only do those people not just come out and say, I want a really lackluster podcast of just two dudes who maybe don't even know they're being recorded practically. And that's what gets me off. There's a bunch of people of the very niche group of people who that is their thing. Huge swath of that don't know it yet. Like, that's a thing you don't just figure out. You have to be presented. And so we didn't get it out there to the right people. We should have brought it to the masses and been like, does this do anything for you?
Well, this is what I will say, though. If we had gone viral, we were consistent. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Every week, you know, we were whatever we did the first time, we kept doing. So it is possible that if anything we'd done had gone viral, that would have been good enough because we were putting in the work and maybe people would have liked that it's not edited. They would have liked all the things about it that allow us to not do anything but just show up. But the going viral thing is really, I mean, it's like winning the lottery. It's not likely going to happen. You're really going to have to advertise or, I don't know. There's lots of stuff you need to do.
For those of you just joining us for the first time, we have a hat. It is magic in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. People write into that email address with sort of whatever the crap they want, but often focused on the fact that we will have to talk about what it is. So a lot of questions, topics, death threats, whatever. The hat magically forwards emails to us. We talk about them. And that's pretty much it. Nowadays, mostly just forwards them to William. Because I've abandoned my email accounts, so. And it's been 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
How was your 2 weeks?
I mean, we did a lot of things. We caught up on American Horror Story, which is through NYC. We watched.
Oh, yeah, because the new one's coming out any second.
Yeah. We watched
with Killing Kim Kardashian in it.
It does.
Yeah, she's the main villain, I think.
Okay.
In the new one, Delicate, yeah.
So, I'll just say this. American Horror Story had a really good concept, and even the ones that, the seasons that weren't great were at least interesting. I could probably watch all of them through Apocalypse, 8 seasons, and enjoy them all. Some of them more than others. But when by the time they got to season nine, the 1980, the one about this, you know, people at camp and stuff like that, you could tell they were running out of ideas. And then Double Feature, they're basically admitting, we don't have any ideas, so we're going to have two things and we're going to split it up, which wasn't that bad. It was kind of they were both science fiction and they were kind of a nod to Twilight Zone, which I think is, that kind of made it even a step up from the previous season. And then NYC,
paid attention since they were in a hotel with Lady Gaga, so none of this even means anything to me.
NYC wasn't even in the horror genre, so I don't know why they did that.
It was just Rent.
It was, I mean, they basically said right in one of the episodes what the horror of the show was, and it was the AIDS epidemic in the in New York in the 80s, which was a horror. But if I made it, if I made a story about the Civil War and the horrors of the Civil War, that wouldn't make it part of the horror genre. That's a historical drama. And that's what it was. It was a poignant historical drama. It was not a bad, I mean, for what it was, for a limited series, it would have, I mean, I think if it would just would have been the standalone thing and not attached to American Horror Story, it would have been very successful.
It was also involving Ryan Murphy. It was called Pose. And it was really good. Why did they make a American Horror Story season of it?
I don't know. But of course, a lot of fans were, you know, disappointed. And I think rightly so. I mean, if it just wasn't, it wasn't an American Horror Story thing. It was interesting and poignant. And like I said, if it was a standalone thing, everybody would have thought it was very well done. Some parts weren't that well done, but I mean, that was because I think they were trying to shoehorn it into something that it was never going to be. There was nothing supernatural or horror oriented with it. I mean, there were, well, I won't get into it, but it's just, two seasons of we're running out of ideas and one season of we don't have any more ideas, but here, watch this. I don't understand. I think Delicate is going to try to get back, of course, to being actually about horror. I have no idea though. I don't know. We watched,
I don't think I even saw a trailer for a season of American Horror Story since Apocalypse. I mean, genuinely hadn't heard of the other ones you mentioned.
Yep. 1980, I think is 1980. Was it 1980 or 1984? I don't know. It was a year, but it was just an homage to slashers, which that's valid for American Horror Story, but it was clearly not. I mean, they usually are going for a little bit higher concept. So it was like, okay, you're finally getting the slashers. So you're done. Right. And then a Double Feature was just two ideas that they didn't think they could make into full thing. And frankly, both ideas didn't probably need five episodes each even, but it wasn't bad. Like I said, it was kind of a nod to Twilight Zone and I appreciated that. NYC, and by the way, nothing about relevant. I mean, it takes place in New York City, but that's it. If it's called American Horror Story NYC, what you kind of expect is New York City is going to be like a character in the story, and you're probably going to delve into some history and other things that happened that make New York City, a subject of horror. But no. Nope. It's like, why even call it New York City?
He already did this. It's called Pose. It was a good show. It's one of my favorite shows. And he was involved.
I know. I mean,
understand. He already made this show. It was good.
Yeah, I don't know. But we also watched Killing Eve, which was very good. I don't think the plot and the character arc sort of wore thin by season four, but it was still well written and well acted, so it was still fun to watch. I just don't think the plot or the arcs really supported four whole seasons, but the writing was pretty sharp still, and the performances were fun to watch, so we liked that. And we watched The Pope's Exorcist.
Ah! And?
Well, I actually appreciated it when I realized immediately what it was. And it's Sony's attempt to make a Conjuring series, right? The Conjuring has the real life demonologists, the Warrens, right? Well, this has a real life exorcist, this guy. And so now they're going to make, you know, Conjuring like films with this real life guy instead of those real life people. And it does. It's a paint by numbers copy of what The Conjuring does. And except
with an outrageously accented priest of Russell Crowe, which, and I choose this word very deliberately, elevates the entire thing to some batshit cinematic universe that I am super here for.
But here, yeah, we'll watch the next one, I'm sure. But here's the problem. The elevator pitch for this should not have been, oh, this is like The Conjuring, except with this real life priest. The elevator pitch should have been, it's like The Conjuring, except with this priest, which means it's The Conjuring meets The Exorcist meets Da Vinci Code. I mean, or something like that. It needed to be more
atmosphere. This guy is the historical figure upon which he is loosely based is the guy who worked with Friedkin to eventually do The Exorcist.
But they didn't shoot it like that. They didn't direct it like that. They didn't give it any atmosphere. Basically, they did it exactly like James Wan did The Conjuring, except with this guy instead. And you can't do it like that. You've got to, maybe they didn't have the budget, I don't know. But like at some point they visit this Vatican archive, and it does not look like the audience wants the Vatican archive to look. I don't care what the Vatican archive does look like. I care about I care what the audience wants the Vatican archive to look like. And it did not look like that.
And
all of the stuff with the exorcism, another thing they did wrong. So the exorcism needed to be more atmospheric. It needed to be more like the Exorcist film or something. But also, they did things that The Conjuring was smart enough not to do. And that is, you can have outrageous things happen, like levitation and things flying across the room and projectile vomit and things like that. But you can't pass a certain point or you're going to lose the audience. It's going to feel like an MCU movie or something. You want the whole hook here is the audience thinks this is based on a true story. This is based on something that actually happened. And you can get away with a little bit of creepy things flying across the room and weird voices coming out of somebody. But if you pass a certain point, no, this is based on a true story thing is lost. And they didn't even stick to that formula as well as The Conjuring people did. So, but I don't know, maybe the second one will be better.
I agree with 100% of everything you have just said. However, it appears that my feelings about the movie are like a photographic negative of yours. I agree with everything you've just said, but all the things that you say, it's better if it's like this, and it's worse if it's like this. I am the exact opposite. To me, this was a boring-ass movie with a story that did not make a whole hell of a lot of sense and felt silly and contrived and dull, and then it became an MCU movie, and I was delighted, not because I'm still into those, but I'm like, yeah, Father Russell Crowe of the impeccable accent basically doing the climactic battle of a Power Rangers movie with another priest and a demon for like the last 20 minutes.
Okay.
And then we're like, oh, this is just the beginning. Like, I fully expected someone in the last scene to, apropos of nothing, pull out a cigar and just light it as like the last shot. This is like Vatican A-Team, and I am super here for it.
Okay, but see, this is the thing. I'm talking about what would make it work like The Conjuring has worked. I'm not, yes. And I don't think you would like Conjuring movies, even if you didn't. Even if you didn't have a problem with the Warrens, I think you would like
them. I know. I know a lot about the Conjuring movies now. And aside from my own personal objections, I don't think they're very good.
No. And so, I'm just talking about, they clearly were going for a Conjuring-like thing. And I'm just saying, for that to work, they would have had to do these things. I don't think it would have made it better for you.
Did,
no.
They did fail at making a Conjuring.
Yeah. But for you, that's good.
Yes. yes. No, and I actually, but I genuinely like wasn't enjoying the experience. And then like the third act happened. And it just became such a drastically different movie out of fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
And then just the most blatant setup for a cinematic universe since Nick Fury walked out of the shadows in Iron Man. Just straight up.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised that happened. I was like, yep, that's what they're gonna do.
This is some Pirates of Dark Water shit where you only found one of the many treasures out there. Let's go. Like, it was very like, just, it's a very mediocre, unimpressive movie that we all can forget about forever, except it made just the right bad steps to turn it into this sort of Frankenstein, no pun intended, thing that I just think is hilarious. Ironically, purely ironically, there is no quality to these films. And I'm already critiquing the films that haven't existed yet, although the second one is in production, or at least was before the strike. Yeah, them's ridiculous.
We also played another Hunt a Killer game.
Wow. You're not off from class, are you? Are you on vacation right now?
No, class technically ends tomorrow. But because of things going on in my life, I was able to.
Oh, you did stuff ahead of time, and so then you had some time. Okay.
Right.
That's right. We got to work out our business if you're about to be done with class.
So we played a game. So this was the first one we did. If you recall, they're graded by difficulty 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And we hadn't done a difficulty 5 game before, and this was a difficulty 5 game. It was also a genre game in that sometimes they have horror-based games, and this was a science fiction-based game. And if you recall, when we did a horror-based game, they really got away from it being a murder mystery kind of thing. And we liked the game okay, but we didn't like that part. Like, we liked the murder mystery thing. We liked LARPing investigators or whatever.
They love death.
This one, likewise, we thought that it being a science fiction setting wouldn't change the fact that you were, you know, working on a mystery or whatever, but it also sort of abandoned that for other things. And so that wasn't great. That wasn't a mark in its favor at all. And also the story, the science fiction story, was not terribly compelling, unfortunately. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. Also the five,
do they have authors?
I don't know. I mean, it's just that,
so I was going to say, maybe you can start to figure out telltale signs of a one that you'd be into versus not.
Sure. Like, you know, sometimes they have licensed stuff, like they have some based on Blair Witch.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we'll do it. I mean, we thought, yeah, we'll try that one, but I don't know if we will, because I think when they do genre stuff, they get way more committed to trying to make it a genre experience, and they just abandon all that other stuff that we like.
Mystery and yeah.
So I think we might just avoid that in the future. And as far as the level 5 difficulty stuff, so as you know, many of these games incorporate codes and cryptograms, and you know, you have to decode things.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that when we first started, because we started with a game that you gave me as a gift, which I'm very grateful for. I'm sure you're very happy with the fact that this has turned into a thing over here.
I'm worried you guys are going to end up in the poorhouse because you're spending all your money on Hunt a Killer games.
They have pretty good sales, and that's what we kind of wait for. But anyway, when we first discovered that there was, you had to solve codes and things, I was a little surprised. It's like, well, what's this really have to do with anything? And the fact of the matter is, the codes often do not really fit in with the plot or with the character or whatever. However, they are a very clever game mechanic. Even when they don't make sense at all to the plot or to the character, they are a very effective game mechanic and a very clever one. And so we actually have grown to really appreciate that particular game mechanic. In this science fiction game, since it was a science fiction setting, the coding and cryptography really worked in well with the plot and everything, which was great. That was fun. And the challenge did go up a little bit on that, but in a fun way. But here's the thing. When it comes to the code breaking part of all these games, there's two parts to it. First of all is figuring out how the code works and maybe decoding a few things to test your theory. If this is how the code works, that's a challenge and it's fun. As soon as you figure that out though, you often have pages and pages and pages of decoding to do. And often the decoded message doesn't give you any insight into anything really. So there's a part of it's a chore, right? You've got a challenge and you've got a chore. And
now they're setting up side businesses where you can offshore that busy work. But they're making it on the back end. Oh, this is brilliant of them.
Well, the five level game that we played upped the challenge a little bit, which was good. That's what we wanted. But the chore went up hugely. I mean, hours and hours and hours to decode something. And most of the time we thought, you know what? The fun part is done. We know how this code works. Why should we spend hours decoding this? Let's just look that part up.
When we could hire someone.
The problem with that, though, is that when you try to look things up, you often accidentally get spoilers. And so if level five just means the challenge goes up a little, but the chore goes up a lot, maybe we won't do level five games. I mean, we'll probably try one more level five game, but we wanted level five just to be more fun because it was more of a challenge. We didn't want it to be 3 days of you decoding stuff. We didn't want that. And we still don't. And level three is fine. It's fun. So
is there, I wonder, an email, a way to contact them and say, like, here's the things we like best about your games.
Maybe, and maybe we'll
have a recommendation.
Maybe we'll do that. But we have really enjoyed
it. Seems like something they'd be prepped for. But
yeah, we've really enjoyed them. We probably enjoyed this game the least, and yet we still felt it was worth it, and we had a great time. I mean, we like this brand and we like their product quite a bit. And you know, you just have to try things out and see what fits for you. And so far it's looking like, you know, maybe we like exactly the kind of thing you got, which was level three murder mystery. You know, it's not super challenging, but it's just challenging enough to be fun. And the plot is fun and the characters are fun and it's just interesting to play.
That's why I picked it. I chose it very specifically for you guys. I'm a little insulted that you felt the need to wander afield. I knew what murder mystery you wanted. I understand these things.
Hey, we're just trying to, we're just sampling the wares of this fine establishment. Mm-hmm. And it has been fun. We don't regret it at all. But next time, I think we will try another level five just to see if they're all the same. But I think we're really going to maybe avoid things that are try to get to a different genre than murder mystery, and we'll just stick with that. But we might not do so. Abby looked at some of the other offerings just to see what she liked, just based on the setting and stuff like that. And you know, there's that superhero one, and she thought that one looked really cool. Maybe we'll do that one next. I don't think it's a level five, but maybe we'll do that one next when it's on sale. Wow, that was a lot. How was your week? Did you have you have it all written down, right?
2 weeks.
That's
two
right.
2 weeks. That was okay. What did I have written down? I was adding things and taking things away. I haven't been, I mean, I did. I actually remember my whole idea with Fallout and playing it as a bad guy in the wrong direction and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. How's that going?
It went very strong for a while. I played a lot for a week or so. I'm a little bit off right now. It is very interesting in my head. There's a lot of dark shit that I sort of didn't remember probably because I refused to do it before. And it's odd, but I'm also starting to play into it. Like, certain things will happen, and I'm in my head, I'm like, that's the first thing that's got her thinking differently about this and stuff like that. It's very hard still. I'm level 22 now. But that's what I find is Fallout's fun that way, in that you can't really gauge how difficult something's going to be based on its level or if it has a skull or whatever. Because just, and this, I'm mostly doing these radio missions, so I'm just going all over the map. So in theory, I'm doing all sorts of different difficulties. But I'm not dying too often. But I am doing a lot of running away and taking a lot of drugs and stuff. Yeah, we'll see. I haven't played it in a few days. I might not get back to it. I'm playing a bunch of old games.
Oh.
And I mean actually old games.
Oh.
What happened is something I watched reminded me of Phantasy Star, which is, it's spelled with a PH, fantasy. And it was an RPG on the Sega Master System, which was the Sega version of the NES. And I loved it. And I loved the second one even more. And they had a third one and a fourth one that I kind of played, but not too much. But I also loved those. And something reminded me of it. And I was like, can you play these somewhere? And I found out, basically, if you want to play the original one, there's only one place. You can get it on the Nintendo Switch. And it was on sale for like $1.50. So I got it. And I played it, and it's very weird to play now. And they've adjusted some things, like quality of life stuff, because it's modern now. It is still, it goes surprisingly quickly now, but it's still boring. So, I don't know. But then I found out there's a Sega Genesis Classics that's like 30 games that you can get for, among other things, the PS4. And it was on sale for $5, so I grabbed that. And now I've got Phantasy Star 2, 3, and 4, which great. And I tried to and forgot about the music. All the music is just so repetitive and really annoying. But I haven't played much of that. But in the process, this also came with like Sonic the Hedgehog and 2 and 3 and Golden Axe and Shining in the Darkness, which is an old dungeon crawler I played. So like a bunch of old games that I haven't played in ages. So that's been kind of fun to like try that out a little bit, but not a lot happening there. I haven't been playing a lot of video games lately. All right, before we get into other things here, I just like moments before we got on here saw the trailer for Fall of the House of Usher. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts? Sorry, we should specify. Fall of the House of Usher appears to be the new Mike Flanagan Haunted House show. He did Haunting of Hill House, and then he did The Haunting of Bly Manor. Now he's doing another one about the House of Usher, sort of.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like he's trying that what he's really doing is he's taking a whole bunch of Poe material and sort of combining it together to make one narrative.
So. Yeah.
And
it so also is coming off as a slasher. Apparently the implication is that the Usher family is some criminal family, some sort of mob based family. And then something from the past in the form of this woman is coming to get vengeance upon them for their evil deeds. And maybe it's supernatural. Probably it's supernatural, but it looks an awful lot just like a slasher.
I'm sort of, I guess. I wasn't sure what to make of it, honestly. I mean, we'll watch it, obviously, but
us too, without a doubt.
But I mean, like Hill House, you know, that only somewhat superficially resembled the source material. You know, he does whatever he wants with this stuff. So. Yeah. I'm interested to see
even more so.
I'm interested to see just, you know, what kinds, what he takes from Poe and how he incorporates it into a single narrative. I suspect that probably of all the things he adapts from Poe, the House of Usher part will be the least, you know, well represented, right? It's the family's name and whatever. But other than that, what's it going to have to do with the short story?
And from what I've seen over the years, adaptations of House of Usher are notably stray very far from the source material.
Yeah. And in fact, sometimes some of the things I've seen are like, I don't know if they understood this story, or they didn't get from it what I got from it anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, you see in the preview, you see indications of other short stories, and, you know, those will probably be represented in a very recognizable way to anyone who's a fan of Poe. But probably the only nod to the House of Usher short story, or, you know, whatever you want to call that piece of fiction that he wrote, the only nod really will just be the name of the characters. There's not going to be anything that really speaks to what Poe was saying or what fall of the House of Usher meant in his story. But other things like Pit and the Pendulum and things, you saw nods to that are going to be more dramatic and obvious, I think.
They say a ton of the word nevermore.
Nevermore. So I think that's going to be interesting just to see what he does with that. But I think the House of Usher part is going to be probably in name only.
But that's fine. Doesn't feel like what I'm used to seeing from him, but I trust him enough to check it out.
Yeah, me too. I look forward to that.
I got to get through some of these quicker here because I have things that I'm remembering that I didn't put on the list.
Oh.
Let's get the two movies out of the way. We saw a movie called The Relic, not to be confused with the old, Guillermo del Toro movie out of the 90s or whatever. This is a relatively new movie on Shudder called The Relic.
Hmm.
It's good. Here's what I will say. If you liked The Babadook, odds are you will like this. It is very obviously metaphoric in a lot of ways, very much like The Babadook was. I will say the premise of the film is an adult woman and her adult daughter, who maybe are kind of estranged, show up to the small town where their increasingly demented mother lives on her own because she's gone missing for 3 days. And then she comes back and things get spookums. But consequently, generational caretaking and the relationships and losing loved ones to dementia are all the primary themes here. Particularly from a female perspective, because it's a grandmother and a mother and a daughter. None of those resonate well with me personally, so it wasn't great for me, because it is a strong enough metaphor that I don't think you can just take it as a horror movie, really. Because if so, you're like, why is that happening and why are they acting that way? It's like, well, so it wasn't for me in many ways, but I think it is quite good. And if you like Babadook and that sort of thing, I would say this is right in that vein and I would recommend it. But it's also, it's not mind blowing. I saw it and I'll probably forget it before too long. Good performances though. So there's a new movie coming out called Godzilla Minus One. And it's clearly a passion project by like one dude in Japan, but it looks like it's pretty cool. But it got Trish looking into the history of Godzilla and learning a bunch of stuff that she found fascinating and I just assumed was common knowledge. Things like his actual name is Gojira and Gojira. He is largely a metaphor for nuclear annihilation and stuff like that. But anyway, so she was very excited about this, and she wanted to see the original Godzilla. And it's on Max from 1954, and I had never seen it. So we watched it. It's very interesting.
Oh, man, it's so good.
Well,
I think it's really good.
That's one of the two things that I was going to mention. It's very interesting because I don't think it's very good.
I think it's great.
The metaphor is really cool. The idea is really cool. The dialogue, the way it's shot, it has very B-movie vibes to me. But, and a lot of the plot is just like, oh, now we're going to be over here. Great.
Did you see, you saw the very original version and not like the one with the Americanized version with, I think, Brian Keith's in it?
I don't believe I saw the Americanized version. No. Okay. So that was what's the original. I know that American editing changed some stuff because some of it was a little too obvious. Some of it's not, but some of it is. And apparently, according to Trish, it wasn't actually that successful in Japan. And then it came to the US and was huge. And then that sort of did a thing. I don't know. But it's not great in terms of just like film craft.
Well, I thought for the time and for what they were trying to do, and the fact that they had a guy in a suit, I thought it was pretty effective. Mm-hmm. I thought it was.
A lot of it, and some of it maybe translate. A lot of it is the dialogue and the acting, and it's just and things that I know from other kaiju. I'm not a big kaiju movie guy in general, but I know from other weird things where like children are allowed in high level military bases and that kind of shit. But anyway, but that's the thing. The second weird part is it is played much more serious than lot of later ones. And, I mean, spoiler for a 1954 foreign film, he dies at the end. They kill Godzilla.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, they even theorize there could be others out there or whatever. But, like, they kill Godzilla. And it has that whole, you know, science versus war conflict things. You can see the seeds of things that show up in later movies, but it's also very different in a lot of ways.
I thought it was very groundbreaking in a lot of ways. And I thought with the technology they had or that they clearly were limited by, I thought all those things considered, it was fantastic film craft. But I mean, it's not great by today's standards by any means, but I mean, and I know you account for that, but what would you compare it to from that same era that you think would be better? You mean like something with stop motion would be better, or?
I don't know. It's not the effects that I have trouble with.
Oh,
it's largely the dialogue and the acting. Oh.
I guess I thought that was...
It's just a goofy... It's clearly a miniature set. No, that's all fine. It's that we're saying absolute nonsense and not just bad science, which I expect. Although some of it, even that was kind of... But I'm like, it's the 50s. We don't fucking know.
Yeah.
But just motivations for people and why they do things and how relationships work, because there's a variety of relationships involved. The plot pacing... It's all very B movie. It's all very much, oh, now there's this thing. Here's a love triangle that I've forgotten about because one of the three players has honestly expressed no interest in anyone else involved ever. Right. But oh, it's a love triangle.
Okay, but I wonder how much of that. Now help me out. Maybe I'm looking at this the wrong way. Some of what you're talking about, I remember. But I remember thinking to myself that it was cultural, right? That the storytelling method here is we've got a through line. We've got this metaphorical, almost philosophical through line, and everything serves that. Even it doesn't have to make perfect logical sense. It doesn't have to serve a plot necessarily. We're telling a very specific story. We're going for a very specific meaning. And so whenever that happened, that you're talking about, I just thought, okay, so this is a culturally different storytelling approach here that I have to adjust my expectations for, but maybe that's wrong.
Well, maybe it's correct. I don't know. I've seen a fair number of Japanese movies.
That's right. You've got more experience with that than I've got.
An
so
expert. And I'm also, as we've discussed before, the one who falls for thinking somebody's a better actor if they're doing it in a different language. And this is the time period where translations were very poorly dubbed and really poorly translated.
Well, sure.
So it's entirely possible if I saw it in Japanese, it was
dubbed that wouldn't be the one you watched?
No, wait. We saw it subtitled. Never mind. They don't have that excuse. I don't know.
Yeah, my experience was completely different, but I didn't notice things.
I didn't dislike it, but I liked it for what it is, and I don't think it did the other things very well. Which is fine. It was a fun time. It's not very long, and it's cool. All right. We got to get to the meat of this, but I want to hit this one really fast. Out of fucking nowhere. This whole answering YouTube's ads, I think it's doing something. Because they're throwing new ads at me, but also they're throwing new videos at me in weird ways.
Okay.
And at one point they actually said, please rate your ad experience. And I rated it poor because they weren't doing so good with me. And suddenly they were flinging out all stuff. But anyway, I get recommendations that surprise me nowadays. And I got one yesterday, maybe the day before, I don't know, recently. It was a video from a YouTube channel called Celebrity Escape Room. And it contained exactly one video posted 3 years ago called Celebrity Escape Room. And what it was, I can only piece together from context clues.
Mm.
But here's my theory.
Okay.
In 2021, maybe? I don't know. 3 years ago. Actually, I think it was 2020 because I think it came out in May of 2020, which means they filmed it just before COVID, probably.
Oh.
The US NBC decided to get in on the popular British children's charity Red Nose Day, which is a thing that's been going on in Britain for years and years and years. And they have special celebrity episodes of shows or joke standalone episodes of shows or little sketches and things like that to raise money to help children in need. And they've been doing it forever and ever and ever. And the US has kind of gotten in on it because there's a lot more sharing of TV. So we kind of know about it. And apparently one day NBC just did a whole day on Red Nose Day of different special things that I don't know about. But at the beginning and the end of this thing, they talked about them. And presumably they all have their own YouTube channel with exactly one thing on it. But this was the entirety of a show they aired called Celebrity Escape Room that was Jack Black playing Jack Black, but like an evil and rich version. And he had trapped, well, there were side bits where he had trapped various celebrities in various escape rooms, and occasionally he would watch them on monitors. But our main thing was Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, Ben Stiller, and who was the other guy? I don't remember, but another guy that would fit in that grouping. He locks them in his mansion and they have an escape room to do. And every puzzle they solve, they win another $15,000 for Red Nose Day charity. And it was bizarre. I don't know that I recommend. I mean, you know, right off the top of your head, does that sound appealing? If so, watch it. It's exactly that. But what cracked me up, and we do this with a lot of things, and we especially do it with charitable ones. So the conceit was, if they didn't succeed, Jack Black was going to use the money to buy himself a Lamborghini Countach. And that's a joke. And I get that joke. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But leading up to it, we make a very big thing throughout that they only have an hour. And every puzzle they solve, will win $15,000 for the charity. And spoiler alert, they solve all of them with like 6 minutes to go. But it's also edited in such a way that they could have had 7 hours. You have no idea. But I just love, and we've had this in other things too, whenever the conceit is like I love the idea that on a certain level, we are all sitting here going, if Ben Stiller can't figure out this memory tile puzzle, the needy children are out 15 grand. Like, I was trying to explain it to Trish, and she's like, what are you? And finally, I'm just like, we are all supposed to believe that how well these celebrities perform has any impact on how much money the poor children are going to get. And we sort of know that's not true, but it means that we're all just engaging in a thing where we're pretending we're the shitheads from Hunger Games. Like, we're all just sitting at home pretending to be the rich people watching the children. In this case, it's not the children. It's watching the arguably has-been older comedians fight to save the children. And we watch it as a competition. And presumably, if we're good, we're rooting for them. But we're also, like, cool with this as entertainment. Like, that's so bizarre. And I'm not claiming that we're all confused. That's part of it. Is I'm not saying we're all heartless monsters from the capital city in the Hunger Games. I'm saying we're all LARPing as the heartless monsters from the Hunger Games.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that's never registered for me before. And there are some that are genuinely competitions where it's like it's $100,000 and the celebrity that wins gets $100 for their chosen charity. And that's fine. But that's also weird, right? I mean, that's also strange that, yeah, unfortunately, you got, you know, Paul Faison during the sport and trivia round, and he's not great at that. So sorry, AIDS research. You don't get that 50 grand. It's going to the thing that spays and neuters pets instead, because Tim McGraw knows his fucking trivia.
Yeah, you're right.
What? What? And how? And it just is layers, because it's like, how is this a thing?
Yeah.
How am I the first person to say anything? And how did it take me this long to sort of figure it out? Mm. Like, we're not monsters, but we like playing monsters. Like, we like being the absolutely useless guys with the gold masks in the second part of Squid Game. Why? I mean, I do like, I mean, and not to unspell again, but British panel shows have this. It's a bunch of celebrities having a goofy competition, but nobody is offering charity for it, which is the weird part. Right?
The offering charity is the weird part, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Being like, this goofy entertainment could win someone in need some money if the guy you got who's famous for that one YouTube video is really good at mini basketball. Like, otherwise, I'm afraid leukemia is going to continue unchecked. Like,
I mean, part of it is
just, I want to watch the YouTube guy play basketball and I want the leukemia to go checked. I've lost my metaphors here, but you know, they should be two separate things.
So there's the benefits, of course, to what they're doing is it it raises awareness. Like the people who are watching are likely going to go, you know what, I could give money to this or that or the other thing.
Yes.
Also, sure. Another point is, it's not so much that this is going to this celebrity to give to a charity. The point is, the celebrity's not going to get it, whatever that is. So the celebrity's not going to be enriched by this. It, in a way, it doesn't matter where else it's going to go. If the celebrity's not going to get it because they're already rich. We don't want to watch a rich person just get richer. So that's part of that.
So instead, we're watching different rich people competing, like genuinely, to see what worthy cause gets their scraps.
And what
other worthy cause is just fucked.
Right. No, that's right. You're not wrong.
And I mean, we're so full of this stuff. I got into a big argument with a friend the other day over the prevalence now of, do you want to round up to pay for a thing or whatever? And all of these are scams. I've talked about this before. If you see a company that's like, for every whatever you buy, we do whatever, you don't need to buy the thing. Because the way these work is, if you look at the fine print, they say, yeah, everyone we sell will donate $1 up to $100,000. Well, guess what? They just donated $100,000, just up front. How many they sell doesn't, they aren't sitting here counting and then going, oh, it was only 42,000. Sorry. No. They say, we'll do it up to this month, and then they just do it, and it doesn't matter anymore. And they only do it for tax write-off and so that we'll think they're a cool charitable company. They do not do it out of some goodness of their heart, not at that scale. So, but this one, like, we're play-acting part of it, and I find that really weird, but kind of hilarious. And I kind of do want to LARP as one of the evil people from the Capitol in Hunger Games. Anyway. All right, we're done with that.
Okay.
We got to move on because we're already over time and I have two TV shows that we finished that I have to talk about.
Oh.
We hadn't finished either before. I know one we finished last time, but we hadn't finished Good Omens 2 yet, had we?
Nope.
I got to speak real careful on this. I don't want to spoil things.
Oh.
Second season was marvelous.
Hmm.
Highly recommend. I maybe liked it better than the first season.
Hmm.
Because it was doing its own thing. It very, very clearly has a lot of fan service built into it. There are a lot of aspects to it that are like, oh, that's what people wanted in the first one. But we had source material in here. We can do whatever we want. We sort of did. And it's got a lot of stuff. Like, the story doesn't always hold together well. And it's just an excuse to watch those two boys strutting around making speeches in character. And that's super fun. It's really pushing on in the comedy. Everybody's really good. I enjoyed it. It was a very sort of sudden wrap up, as these things often are. But I enjoyed the ending. This is where I have to talk really carefully. They did something exciting happened in the very, very end. And I did not expect it, which I'm surprised that it could surprise me like that. On a very personal level, having nothing to do with the quality of the show, I was upset by the ending. Again, personal, not like this show sucks, but like I don't like how the story ends. It also at the time felt very artificially done to give us a reason to watch another season.
Oh.
And I absolutely hate that.
Yeah.
I have looked into it a little bit since, and I am not sure that's what's happening. And in fact, part of me is like, this might have been intended to be a real end. And how do I feel about it? Then it still upsets me, but there are endings that upset me that I still think are a really good ending.
Right.
Like that tragedy is tragedy. So, and apparently there is talk to do a third season and it would be a final season. But then of course that's all up in the air because of the writer's strike and everything. So
right.
Who knows? So I have a lot I'm processing there, but it's marvelous. Highly recommend.
Okay.
You got to watch the first season first, which is also very good, but I don't know. It's better. I think sometimes something that's a really good book shouldn't turn into a movie or a TV show, even if you did a really good job. Like sometimes right. It's because you're bad at doing it, but sometimes it's like, no, that was a book. It doesn't work outside
right.
of that.
Right.
Which brings me to my last thing. Last night, we finished The Peripheral.
Oh, what'd you think of that?
I got things to say about The Peripheral, or as we called it regularly, The Peripheral. We had this thing where we would ask the other, what do you want to see? And if you wanted to see The Peripheral, we got into a thing where we both would just swallow the word. And so at a certain point, it became a joke. Like, what do you want to watch? Peripheral. All right, we'll watch Peripheral. It's real pretty. It's real, real gorgeous. I had an experience the whole time where I enjoyed watching it, but I was just constantly punched in the face with, this is a book, and it should have stayed a book. Like, it is full of character traits and character decisions that seem to come out of fucking nowhere, or relationships that have certain things happen that I'm like, I'll bet if this was a book and I had a little internal narration and things, I would feel different about these people right. and about their situation.
Right.
And so I also wouldn't go backward. Like, I was like, I'm going to watch this, and that pretty much guarantees I won't ever read the book, but I'm like, okay, whatever. It also, I realized very early, doesn't have a lot happen in it.
Mm-mm.
It is, here's what I'm going to go, because I cannot say it is poorly acted. It is brilliantly acted. I think it is very poorly directed.
Yeah, that's fair, I think.
You know how in a line or a monologue, people will sometimes pause for sort of emotional things? Well, the director of this certainly knows that, and is assumes the more the better. The number of like 20 minute pauses in the middle of a sentence that not only lend nothing to the gravitas of the moment but feel very artificial. They don't feel like the person was just pausing, caught up in emotion. They're like, no, someone told them to stop talking, and then later someone told them to start talking.
Yeah.
It is also villain monologue the TV show.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's pretty bad and that way.
Distractingly so, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of scenes where people go to places and do things to give a threatening monologue that is 100% information we and this recipient of the monologue already knew, and then leave. Constantly. But they are good monologues.
Oh yeah, good actors doing good stuff.
And there are some really impressive villain things that do not make sense. You're like, that makes you a bad villain to do that, but it's really fun to watch. Yeah. And there's a lot of that. And then early on in the last episode, you're like, actually, Trish said it out loud. She's like, baby, I don't think anything is going to be resolved here. And the last couple episodes, we kind of explained what was going on, and I kind of got a sense of it. So I don't feel a tremendous amount of cliffhangerism here. But it just wasn't interesting.
Mm.
like the big reveal of what's happening, I'm like, oh, okay, that's a sci-fi version to do that. And that's what it boiled down to, is ultimately this is a corporate espionage show, and that's all it is. We have tremendous sci-fi components in it, but it's just about various pretty icky parties vying over corporate MacGuffins.
Right.
And it's very clearly just setting up for more stuff, and kind of out of nowhere, like a lot of stuff people didn't know, and then they learned it, and then they acted as though that was normal, and that's what they always knew. Like, there's a lot of mobilizing happening at the end of the season that I'm like, we spent 7 episodes doing nothing, and then the 8th episode we're doing a lot, and I'm not even sure I understand why we're doing a lot of it.
Right.
And I look into it, and I'm like, why did they do... I mean, I know why, but I'm like, what? Well, Trish looks in later. Apparently, the Peripheral, the novel, not standalone. It's the first of a trilogy that the third one hasn't even come out yet.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Even though the fourth one came out 9 years ago. Hmm. So, if I'd known that going in, I don't think I would have watched it. Which might have been to my detriment, because it was a really fun watch. I enjoyed it. I also really enjoyed the Book of Boba Fett. Like, that thing's ridiculous. And this thing is pretty ridiculous. But it was a fun time. Lots of cool visuals and stuff. But if I had known up front that actually this is based off of the first book in a trilogy that hasn't been finished, I don't know that I would have gone for this. And it's all moot, because apparently it was renewed, and then later that renewal was canceled, basically because of the writer's strike, because at this point it would be 2025 before they could have a second season out, and who would have paid any attention that long?
So. I think the Foundation TV show also proves that the Asimov stuff just shouldn't, there's no point. It's not,
absolutely,
it was never written for that, and to make it, basically, most of the changes you see from the books to the TV show, when you think about it, some of those things had to be done to make a decent TV show, but there's so many changes, it barely resembles the source material, so why?
Well, and I'm just seeing them more and more and more now, and I guess I'm getting used to knowing what to watch. I would watch a scene in the Peripheral, and I'm like, I'll bet that's a concept that has been really subtly drawn out throughout the book and caused me to feel certain ways about it. And you've now switched it to a really clunky 30-second monologue.
Yep, yep.
So I know the things you want me to know.
Yeah.
But I do not feel the things you want me to feel.
Correct, correct. Yep.
So yeah, it's fun. I mean, I'm not sorry I saw it. And it's got some neat things in it, but don't expect, read the book if you want the story, presumably. Don't expect any kind of resolution.
Well, I mean, you and I often point out that the medium a story is told in matters. I mean, it's not just a disembodied story that you can pick up and put in some other medium. You know, if it was told in a book first, something about a book is part of that story now. Same with movies, same with TV shows, you know, same with comic books. Now that being in a comic book or whatever is part of that story now. And to adapt it to something else, you can't just pick it up and drop it in. There's lots of changes you'll have to make. And sometimes those changes are going to change the story so much that there's not really even any point doing it, but people do it. Try anyway.
And this is all over the place. There's all sorts of examples out there. Some of the best, and occasionally, if you're lucky, you get an adaptation that's a terrible adaptation, but a good its own thing.
Right. Like I like the Foundation TV show just fine. I don't think it's a very good adaptation of Asimov, but I like it okay.
The Keanu Reeves Constantine movie.
Mm. Yeah, you always use that example. Yeah, use that example.
It's a bad adaptation, or one that is more controversial, but that I feel. I liked the book Dune. I also liked the 1984 secretly directed by David Lynch movie of Dune is a bad adaptation of a book that I'm not sure could be well adapted.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's like
I'm already kind of annoyed. I saw the trailer for the second part of the Denis Villeneuve one, which I definitely didn't want to see because I didn't give a shit about the first one. It was really long, and I'm looking at it. I'm like, shit. I mean, mostly Christopher Walken as the Emperor of the Known Universe is a tough one to walk away from, but we shall see. But these kind of things happen all the time. But then, like, some that are considered very good adaptations, the Harry Potter books, yes, there are people who watch them who didn't read the books who like them. There aren't a ton. And as somebody who we were in a controlled experiment in my house, because I read every book before I watched the movie, and Trish never read a single one, we found out there was a lot of stuff that was very confusing to her until I explained it to her afterward.
Same in this household. Abby read all the books. I didn't read a one. She thought, wow, that movie was great. I said, I did not understand this. Oh, well, because of this. It's like, yes, the person who read the book understands that, but the person who didn't doesn't.
That became a thing we would do where I was like, okay, tell me all the things you don't understand. And sometimes I could be like, yep, if that was in a book, you'd know this. Or sometimes I'd be like, yeah, that's just never made sense. That's just because there is some stuff like that in Harry Potter as well. Lord of the Rings did a pretty darn good job, but not a great job, as evidenced by the fact that The Hobbit became 7 hours of movie.
Yeah,
but it happens all the time. This is another good example of that, and I'm learning that I have to pick whenever there's a film adaptation or TV adaptation of something, I have to pick up front. And that if for some reason I have experienced the two of them up front, I need to try and divorce the two.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But also in general, I just try to avoid adaptations of stuff nowadays. We'll see.
The one exception to adaptations that I've noticed is sometimes novel adaptations of movies are quite good. Like, and not in a way that contradicts or bothers the original. Like the novel adaptation can sometimes like fill in some holes and things that the movie had. So sometimes a novelization of a film can actually like be a good companion to the film.
Yeah, in a way.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, and sometimes not everything that started out as a book should have been a book.
That's right. That's true too. You are right about that.
And there are versions of that out there where I'm like, that wasn't a great book. Oh, I made a really cool TV show.
Yeah, exactly.
Or a really good movie. So, and this is the thing I'm discovering, because one of the video game critics I watch did this sort of diatribe one time. He's like, we still haven't learned what video games are for, in that, well, like we've talked about, when they made film, they first just did stage plays, filmed, and it was only over a lot of time and trial and error that you're like, no, there are things you can do with film that you could never do on a stage.
And cameras and sound and everything.
Yes. And that has become a thing. And television had some of that. And television's also developed other aspects that aren't so much about the technology, but about the format.
Right.
And in the same way that a novel and a short story differ not just because of their length.
Exactly right.
In the same way, video games can give you something narratively that no other medium can. And very few games have figured out what that is or how to do that. It's usually just like, oh, this is a movie, but it's also interactive. Or that's not the point of it in a lot of ways. And so nowadays, more and more, I'm very hyper aware with any media I'm in. I'm like, is this the media for this? And where I witness it most often is when somebody adapts the book.
Yeah.
Because that's sort of the classic one. But more and more, I'm like, I don't think this is what this meant for. Or sometimes, clearly the artist thought this was for, and it doesn't necessarily lend itself to adaptation, but there's a vision they created, and you can see this now with a lot of directors, there are certain directors that you're like, this would be nonsense written down. It's about the visual presence of it and things like that.
Yep. Agreed.
So I pay attention to that stuff a lot. But, that's interesting. We didn't get to a question. We have one, but we didn't get to it, which we expected. But also, much to my shock, William did a lot of things in the last 2 weeks, which doesn't normally happen.
Too.
None of us were prepared for that.
I know. I wasn't prepared either.
But luckily, I did not too much. All right. Well, in the meantime, go to the blog, magicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us your thoughts on anything. Anything you'd like. Also, no, that's it. Just go to the blog. And listen again next week, because next week we'll probably read an email. Who knows? I don't.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.